Welcome to Healthcare and Hire, a podcast for healthcare professionals and aspiring healthcare executives looking for information, association, and inspiration from higher-level leaders across the healthcare industry. I'm Iqbal Acha, career consultant, healthcare recruiter, and registered pharmacist. Every week, I sit down to interview healthcare executives, clinical leaders, medical entrepreneurs, and industry experts to learn how they got to where they are today, what they see as the future of healthcare, and what they're doing to make healthcare more accessible, affordable, and effective. Let's find out more about today's guest. Dr. Richard Hom is the National Optometric Director for Anthem. He is the clinical subject matter expert for the vision management team and collaborates with vision care providers and primary care medical providers to reduce the overall cost of eye and systemic medical conditions. Dr. Hom joined Anthem in 2012. Prior to this, he served as a primary care optometry consultant at San Mateo Medical Center, an Oracle strategic account manager at SGI, and a lieutenant colonel for the United States Army. Outside of his professional roles, he serves as a trustee for the California Optometric Association and an adjunct professor at both Western University of Health Sciences and the New England College of Optometry. Dr. Hom received his Doctor of Optometry degree from the University of California, Berkeley, a PhD in biomedicine from Salus University, and a Master's in Public Administration from San Francisco State University. He is a critical component of the leadership team that helps to advance business and strategic planning for equitable, compassionate, and effective healthcare outcomes. Hello, Dr. Hom. Welcome to the Healthcare and Hire podcast.
Good afternoon, and it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to talking about healthcare and eye care.
I am as well. Dr. Hom, it's a pleasure to have you because I've read a lot about you over the last couple of days and weeks. You have a very proliferative resume and a very expansive topics of interest that I really want to delve into. I know that those that are listening to the podcast today, some of them know you, some of them do not. I'd love for us to take this opportunity and have you introduce yourself. So Dr. Hom, why don't you share with us a little bit about who you are, what your role is, and how do you take healthcare to a higher level?
Thank you. My name is Richard Hom again, and I'm the director or optometric director at Anthem. And I'm also faculty member at the Western University College of Optometry, as well as the New England College of Optometry. What I do is to collaborate and join forces with optometry and primary care medicine so that we can extend the healthcare and eye care together of any in particular individual or group of individuals. This is the new direction, what I think of optometry, is to collaborate with medical care, because I believe that the total eye care and healthcare are really one and the same. They're not separate. And what we really have to do is try to find a way to work together. There are many areas where we can, and we just have to find those areas that we can easily and quickly do. I'm also involved in the business and strategic planning for making healthcare and eye care more accessible to more groups of people, more different subpopulations like age groups, as well as in the different geographical areas. And I think that's the direction of healthcare and vision care, I believe, is as we try to find new directions of how we can collaborate, we're also going to find out that we can reach more people for giving them to give them affordable eye care, which can collaborate therefore into healthcare.
I love the way that you shared that with me, because I think, you know, most of the listeners today, when they've heard Anthem, I think that they're very familiar with Blue Cross Blue Shield. It's almost like a hand-in-hand connection. But, you know, there's rare to find an optometric professional working in managed care, at least within my network and within my scope. So you're something that I would say is like a blue diamond. You're unique. And I think what's important for the listeners also to understand is that while many people associate Blue Cross Blue Shield as the face of Anthem, Anthem is a much larger organization. It is actually the largest for-profit managed healthcare company in the United States. It has 40 million members within the health plan division, but it's actually, you know, taking care of 107 million people with all of its multiple subsidiaries. One of the things that I know of as being a former employee of Anthem is that it is currently ranked number 23 on the Fortune 500, and that there are multiple subsidiaries of Anthem, including mail order of IngenioRx, managed care, CareMore Health specifically, as well as palliative care, and then also behavioral health, such as Beacon Health. So a variety of different things that make Anthem the organization that it is today. And your role in the company is also very unique, you know, and I would love to, you know, have an understanding of, you know, the way that you see things, that you're coming to this show with, you know, decades of experience, both in a direct patient care facing provider role and in a strategic role as well. So you get to see how the world is changing and shifting. Is there something that you feel that, you know, Anthem as an organization has identified as, you know, something that is a huge problem for the country, and that they have decided to say, hey, let's go ahead and take this on because they realize the impact that they can have? Or is there something that you've been a part of where you recognize that as your company has addressed and tried to resolve for? I would love to be able to hear some of your insights in those spaces.
One of the unique badges I've had prior to coming to Anthem is having a sound experience and educational background to prepare me for this role. For instance, I'm a curious person, intensely curious. And so one of the things I'm curious about is how can eye care and healthcare become more real, more relevant, more valid for just the average member? And so one of the newest goals, objectives, and initiatives within Anthem, which is no surprise, is social determinants of health. And one of those outgrowths is food as medicine. That's just one of them. But no longer is it possible to just take care of people who are sick. And I think Anthem is now, and as also Vision Care, is now thinking about how we can start to begin as early as possible in the sick condition range or paradigm or continuum. And we all know that if we can prevent people from getting sick earlier, then either the treatment is going to be easier and less painful, or the seriousness of any particular condition is less. So one of the things we're looking at is, as I said before, is I have had over 20 years experience in large scale healthcare networks, both at the federal government and at the county level, as well as with private organizations. One of the largest is being an HMO in California. So therefore, I've always stood for how can we look for ways to prevent the severity of conditions. And it's not just saying, okay, I see that, and then I'll just refer it. It's like actually managing it with actively and making sure it gets done, and then returning and saying, okay, becoming an active partner is what I'm saying. So I'm lucky to have had a PhD in population health and social determinants of health, as well as a master's in public policy, which encompasses how to make this a national issue that a company like Anthem can attack. So I'm glad that Anthem puts the whole total person, a 360 view of the person, as being one of their primary initiatives and objectives in solving the nation's health.
Dr. Hum, I think you might have hit the nail on the head. You know, for so many decades, healthcare professionals have operated in their own silos, right? Like medical doctors only strictly look at the case that's being presented to them, run some diagnostics, and then they prescribe. Pharmacists just simply do their thing. It's very, very disjointed. You as an optometrist working for a managed care organization, you know, you must have a large, pretty well-connected interdisciplinary team that you work with. And I think that that's really remarkable. You know, maybe it's something that you can share with me, because I know that as we start to see the shape of healthcare changing over the next 5 years, you know, managed care, particularly for eye care and for optometry, is requiring sort of like a mind shift, right? For professionals in this area, they have to try to be more, you know, transparent in what they do, but at the same time, have information that's being supplied by different healthcare professionals. How do you see the industry changing to adapt to this? And or how do you see, optometrists and other healthcare providers within the optometric and eye care space acclimating to this new model?
Well, I think that what's potentially something that's going to be very revolutionary for eye care or healthcare professionals in general is the use of data. Previously, the only data that we have used is what's in the chart. But we all know that there is a finite number of resources, whether it's people, whether it's money. So we have to be able to use all of these resources efficiently. And one of the ways that we can efficiently use it is tie our efforts to outcomes. What do we do that can really make a difference in people? What can we do to shift people to use procedures, processes, management strategies to get the best bang for our buck, to make sure that the care is given at the right time, the right place, and for the right person? We've started to do that. I know that there's a resistance in some parts to adopting it because they feel that the data that's collected seems not necessarily related to their particular work. But that's because each individual is still looking at what they individually can contribute, as instead as each being a person who can contribute to the overall solution of a problem. Now, luckily, we don't necessarily depend on everybody, every provider or doctor needing to participate in this fashion. We needed just enough of them. And then what happens is we educate doctors in trying to shift their point of view, shift their mantra so that they can adopt more of a holistic approach to eye care and healthcare. So again, the first thing in this transition is recognizing that data and outcomes are tied together and they are just instruments, just tools to get us to the most efficient use of our resources and for the best outcomes.
I like that answer a lot, Dr. Hammond. Thank you for that. You know, I want to kind of talk about data, and I also want to talk about how different healthcare professionals use data, but in a different perspective. So one of the things that I have seen, and again, one of the things that I pride myself about the show is, you know, when we invite guests to come to the show, we invite them for a variety of reasons. They represent a certain discipline of healthcare, usually varied. They work for an organization at a higher level so that they're able to see things that are coming down the pike and talk about, you know, strategic initiatives. But I think another factor that makes me really proud and makes this show different is that we have people of color and a more diverse representation. And one of the things that I find is that, you know, when we think about, you know, especially in the last few years, as diversity has come to the forefront in terms of representation at both a clinical level and a leadership level, and how it balances, you know, the patient populations that we take care of, there is a disconnect. And while it is slowly changing, you know, it often makes me wonder about, you know, what are some of the barriers that exist? Is it sometimes, you know, and this is just a friendly conversation between two healthcare professionals, but I think it's interesting that we should have it, because sometimes if you ask somebody, they will say, you know, the reasons why you don't see enough diverse representation at a leadership level for healthcare organizations is because there are systemic barriers. And others will challenge that, and they will say it's not a systemic barrier as much as there is a lack of interest or a lack of drive. You know, I'm curious to know from your perspective, you know, having gone through, you know, an eclectic and a very broad-based career yourself, you know, what are your takes when you think about some of the professionals that go through optometry school, pharmacy school, medical school, dental school, and they don't go beyond a certain level within their organization? Is that something that's self-taught, community-driven, or is it truly a systemic barrier issue or a combination thereof?
Well, it's a combination of two. First, I'll talk to the area of what I call helping others to by promoting people. So one of the advantages of my military service is that one of our objectives of military service was we were tasked to promote junior enlisted people to be senior non-coms. And we're actually tasked and given the tools on how to do that. And I'm proud to say I've had one of the highest rates of promotions for junior enlisted. That's the curiosity, though. I talked about curiosity. So an individual has to be curious enough as, what can I do to bring another person up to the level that they can start to lead? So each individual leader, whether it's myself or somebody else, has to recognize that in order to grow the diversity, they've got to lead not just by being a model stature. They have to look and reach down and say, let's mentor, let's teach, let's invigorate people to achieve more variety of things. Because, you know, realistically, in just the practice of healthcare, people may seem to have a zenith to their career. I've made my practice. I'm very generous, and now it's time to retire. Well, what I believe in, and the reason why I became a trustee of the California Optometric Association, is a way to raise other people to lead the organization. That means to provide insight, wisdom that healthcare professional can go beyond their scope of what they do, and that there is a contribution that they can give further. So when I contribute to people's lives by promoting, bringing them up, giving them mentorship, then that means that they can give back to the person below. It's a continuing process. And I believe that we don't have enough of that, so there's got to be a starting point. So now that is considerably maybe a slow process, but that's how you create leaders. You create leaders by identifying people because you're curious about them, you recognize their ability, you recognize the fact that they might have an interest, and you have to cultivate it. Now, one of the things is that in healthcare, there are not necessarily a plentiful array of leadership positions. I believe it's because many healthcare professionals may look to the traditional types of leadership roles. What I mean saying is, oh, I just want to be a medical director or something like that. But in a lot of situations, if you have the experience, like I took a sabbatical from healthcare and went straight into a supercomputer company. So I was in technology for 3 or 4 years. And so I got to see how leadership and management was at that level, completely different from healthcare. And so I bring to that that particular viewpoint that an individual in healthcare can actually be very versatile. And what they have to be able to convince the people who are looking at them is, no, I'm not just a doctor. I'm a leader. I'm a manager. I am the person that can give a strategic vision. I can invigorate people. I can encourage people. So what we have to think of ourselves is that we can be more than just a healthcare professional. And so when I think of myself, I don't necessarily think of myself as only a healthcare professional. I'm thinking of myself as being, okay, I am going to try to guide an organization, assist an organization to go from point A to point B, and use the means necessary so that there are winners and not losers. Everyone wins. And that means that you have to have a grasp of as many tools, of as many viewpoints, as many backgrounds as you can. And so that's the second thing, is that we have to get out of the notion that we're only one. So again, the first one is identifying people below you, raising them up, mentoring peers, raising them up. And then afterwards, thinking of ourselves as being more than just healthcare practitioners. We are actually leaders and visionaries. That will create the opportunities.
So, Dr. Hom, how does somebody develop those leadership skills when they are not in a leadership position?
I have to say that volunteerism is the big deal. So I knew that quite early in my career, I actually volunteered to do medical camps for a couple of camps in farm workers camps in California very early in my career. When you are working in a volunteer group, there is really little structure. They will look to you to actually manage and lead. And I've taken that skill level and keep and add it on. So I actually volunteer at medical camps, and I'm frequently asked to help the site leader to organize and to configure the layout so that we can create that. So that's one thing, is to do volunteer work, because every nonprofit organization or volunteer opportunity is always seeking for people with skills. And for a lot of things, the nonprofit organization is begging for people with leadership. You can sit on boards of directorships or board of trustees and gain the information about how. So that's why I participated as a trustee in my in the California Optometric Association for the past 7 years. And that's to cultivate the leadership skills necessary to become. And of course, I'm a military officer. That also helps. We've got training. So if you haven't been in the military, again, volunteering as much as possible, taking on projects in your normal work where you are given the responsibility for an outcome, managing assets and resources, meeting budget requirements, delivering the product as well. That's why my work in the high technology is so important, because they are very astute, very keen on budget and delivery on time. They are very keen. So those are some of the skills necessary, because once you get a command of that level of skill, then the struggle isn't about achieving the objective. The struggle really is about getting people to share your vision. That's leadership, because leadership means following somebody who's got a vision that I share, that I want also. So again, we first of all have to master the tools so that it's so automatic that now we can think about the curiosity, the vision, the leadership that we can give others.
That's remarkable. And I really appreciate how you emphasize that volunteerism doesn't not have to start at the top. It is a matter of administrative tasks, organization, things that most people choose not to do and hope that somebody else does for the sake of, you know, glory or for the sake of, you know, exposure. When in reality, you know, those are the founding building blocks of what success looks like. And so I'm glad that you called that out. And I also appreciate the fact that, you know, you've volunteered your time to serve as a board of trustee member for the California Optometric Association. That's a huge commitment. I've been on that side for pharmacy before. And I also know that you are a Toastmaster, if I'm not mistaken, because I can detect those communication and leadership skills just emanating from you, which I think is great. I'm also a DTM, so this is beautiful. But I think that it's important that, you know, there are so many different groups, both professional, non-professional, nonprofit, and even like local organizations that really need manpower. And in return, you learn a lot of great skill sets in the way. So there's always an opportunity to grow and learn in these things. So I agree 100%. Dr. Hamm, we've talked a lot about, you know, your professional career, your company, and a lot about, you know, how you demonstrate excellence in these spaces. I kind of want to focus a little bit more on you now and kind of have a good understanding of, you know, some of the ways that you perceived opportunities. Like, you know, when I take a look at your career, you know, obviously you've pointed out that currently you serve as a professor at the New England College of Optometry while you are concurrently an associate professor at Western University of Health Sciences. You are also the research director at the International Academy of Safe Practice Standards, in addition to serving as the optometric director at Anthem. That's a lot of hats to wear for one individual. So kudos to you and your past. You know, when we think about like your curiosity that led you to work for, and I apologize, Dr. Hamm, what's the name of the company that you work for in the IT space?
It was Silicon Graphics, which was called SGI, and it actually was acquired by a company, which I forgot the name of it, and I also worked for a company called Network Appliance. or that commonly called NetApp.
Okay, very cool. I mean, like, those are all such great stepping stones along the way that have built you into both, again, the professional and the person that you are today. When this opportunity to serve as an optometric director at Anthem came to you, like, what were some of the parameters that you looked at before you said yes? How did you know that this position would be a good fit for you and align with your principles, your factors? Like, what were your values? And how did you know that this would be a good step for you?
Well, I actually thought of it as a natural progression, because in the military, I became more than just a clinical officer. I became a person that wanted to give an impact to more than just a small area. It was over a wider area. And that followed naturally when I was the coordinator of primary care for a county healthcare system for optometry. Then I had over 800,000 covered lives, in which I was responsible for 140,000 of them. So now I was trying to get a bigger impact. So in a lot of respects, coming to Anthem was, wow, it's a bigger sandbox. I can really make an effect on a lot more people. Now I can have an effect or impact on doctors, not just the people who we give care, but the whole continuum of care, from the doctors to the members and to their families, as well as to the people who finance all of this, the employers and the funding groups. So now it's a, like I say, it's a lot bigger sandbox. And for a lot of people, you know, the ability to adapt to that shift of focus really depends on your background and curiosity. So I've been continuously curious about, okay, I'd like to do this. Can I expand it? So in many ways, what I'm doing now resembles only slightly what I did in the beginning. So therefore, I've been able to mold a lot of projects, a lot of new initiatives in what I do. And that's because of my curiosity and good management and leadership above me have recognized that these are possibilities. And some of them work and some of them are not feasible, but still I'm always going to offer new ways to look at things, new ways to execute. So in a lot of respects, you've got to have that curiosity. You know, that is the absolute one. And so I always like to say is that the difference between a PhD and a master's and otherwise is the way to satisfy and get a PhD is that you're curious. If you're not curious, you'll never be able to finish the PhD. Because if that's your curiosity is, why is this happening? What is happening? What's the reason for this happening? Can we prove that this happens and will be repeatable? You've got to have that curiosity, which is an element, in my opinion, in leadership and management. You've got to say is, what if we could do something different? What if we could do this way? What if we had these people doing the way this? So again, I think that I'm lucky to have a great background to prepare me for this role. And it's still a role that required a lot of new experiences, new tools, new strategies, new skills, because it is a bigger sandbox. I have to always say is the fact that, you know, whatever I do or say may not necessarily impact the individual, but actually a lot more people. So, you know, it's a lot of responsibility.
I can only imagine how remarkable of an opportunity it has been for you. And I think what's more important is, like, when I hear you speak, you know, I hear how you're able to really change the shape and the trajectory of what the future of managed care and of healthcare in general is really going to look like. Like, you are probably attending several conferences as a speaker where you're talking about a situation or an issue that needs to be addressed, let alone what's already on the table. Is there a recent conference that you spoke at that you feel comfortable sharing on this show about, you know, the impact that you were able to leave on your audience and how you may have even been able to change or influence any of your audience members to take a different look at an impactful issue?
The one I can really say safely is that I hearken back to this is a very similar skill. So I hearken back to my days at Network Appliance. I stood as a speaker at Oracle Open World, many hundreds of people in the audience. At that particular time, I talked about Linux. Hadn't been known, well known, and the skill to deliver the benefits of Linux, the skill in delivering and creating a vision for the listeners to understand parallel computing, which was my experience at supercomputing. That's the skill to try to mold something, which a lot of people had no experience in, into something that says, hey, that's what I wanted to do. So that same skill now, the topic of healthcare and payers is probably just a small factor in a small part in eye care and professionals. Most people are interested in the medical science of this stuff rather than the operational aspects. So I don't have the wide exposure on the stage. I do teach a course on the introduction of managed and vision care at the Western University College, and I'm going to be teaching it. I've taught it for, I'm going into my second year of teaching. So that is kind of like a forum, and that's for all of the students that go to that college. So I would say that, but it's the same thing. What I'm trying to do is trying to make it as real to them, that it is a friend, not necessarily a foe. And actually, realistically, people have to understand that what I want to understand and try to convey is the fact that healthcare is delivered, but it has to be delivered to the right people, the right time, the right time, and the right place at the right amount of money. We really don't have unlimited resources, and so what we have to be able to do is deliver the care, do it well, and make sure that you can do it within the confines of what the payment schedule is going to be. And we just don't have enough money. The government doesn't have money. Employers don't have the money. Individual out of pocket. And what we have to do is the fact that we all have to work together to try to give us the best care.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that sometimes that gets lost both on the patient's perspective and the provider's perspective. And, it's a reality. I think that anyone that is not willing to look at that from a realistic lens is probably going to do a disservice or potentially even harm in some capacity. Dr. Hom, you've talked quite a bit about having an innate curiosity, and maybe it's not the word innate that I should use, because, some people are not born that way. They don't have this natural curiosity, but they develop that. And I'm curious to know, maybe early on in your career, maybe through your military service, was there a lesson that you learned through experience that changed the way that you approached opportunities or approached problems? Because I think that most of the time we have this idealistic image of, hey, if it's A, then the next step is B. If it's B, then the next step is C. And then you thrust theory into reality and you realize, hey, that's not how things work. What was that aha moment for you that changed how you see things? I'd love to hear that story.
I think that one of the key factors is that early on, I always thought about working with groups of people rather than individual. Although I owned a private practice for several years, I felt that my life was different. So when I graduated, I actually took the unusual step of volunteering for the military. That was way out of, at that time, 1975, it wasn't really what people did. I wasn't on scholarship or anything. I just said, I'll volunteer. And the reason for that is I wanted to have a new experience and a new idea about going completely outside of my comfort zone. Up to that time, I probably never even left the state of California. So now I'm now in Germany, working side by side with people who have similar viewpoints about how to do medical care in a military situation in a very limited amount of resources. So one of the things I learned quickly is how to accomplish tasks with a very small set of resources and with a time frame that is very short and still be expected to deliver an outstanding result. It's quite possible that experience changed my complete outlook and when I came out of the military about how I approach projects. So in a lot of respects, when I develop ideas and plans, I'm already thinking of three or four different ways to achieve it. And what happens is that if, and I will shift my attention span, if I'm stymied by one direction, I'll immediately pivot and go to another direction. Because what's important is the time frame. I still have to deliver the outcome in the same time frame. And what I have to do is recognize at what point that it is not profitable or resourceful enough, or is not going to be successful to go down that path. So the ability to shift at the right time, at the right moment, to another way of doing things is important. Now, it's, you know, a lot of times you could be accused of doing it too late, and even sometimes being it too early. But in all circumstances, whether it's too early or too late, even the second alternative will still get to there. But at least, you know, if something happened, you had a second, third. So that is the one thing that I've really learned how to do, is to look at one, two, or three different approaches to get to the issue solved. I also think I've met some very important people along my life that really helped me look at the expansiveness. So and that's another thing that really helped me, is these key mentors for me. And everyone should have a mentor, even as old or young as you could be, that you continue to listen. So one of the
let's talk about that for a second, Dr. Hum. Is there a particular individual that you feel is really the cause of your success throughout the course of time? I mean, we have all had mentors. Hopefully we've all had mentors, and hopefully we've had a few sponsors along the way. But usually there's like one individual that really either started it for us, or they really invested their time, effort, and energy into developing us, that helped us become as successful as we are. Is there one in particular? And of course, you're more than welcome to name more than one, but I always like to kind of delve into this space.
Well, one of the earliest persons that I can really appreciate is a former executive director of the American Optometric Association, who happened to also have a public policy master's as well as a PhD in public policy. And his name is Barry Baresi, very talented individual. And I had a chance to sit with him on several occasions to just listen to him about the whole concept of healthcare in a public policy setting. And up to that time, I hadn't gotten my public policy degree, but automatically, and just by hearing him, I started to realize that in order to create some of the results, we have to appreciate what it takes. What kind of resources, what kind of evidence, what kind of messaging necessary for funding. So unlike public health, public policy is talking about what are the legislative, executive processes, procedures, evidence necessary to deliver the resources necessary for somebody else. And that's the area that I always wanted to play in, is because and rather than just straight public health, I wanted to get into the idea of how do we go about marshaling the resources, the people, and the thought leaders in order to go the direction. So I, you know, listened to him at least four or five times. And that message still resonates with me about how he was able to formulate a vision for somebody. And he's still doing it now as a leader in seminars, but I had a great chance to listen to him. The second thing that I want to say is you can listen to people, you may not meet them as mentors, but I have to say that if you ever get a chance, my audience, to look at the old speeches of Steve Jobs. When I listened to Steve Jobs in 1996, I was like mesmerized, you know, what he had to say. And it was with Scott McNeely and Steve Jobs at the audience. And Scott McNeely knew that Steve Jobs owned the stage. If you ever want to know how to lead people, to marshal people, to create imagery, that's the type of person you lead. So that gave me the idea of, well, you know, if you want to be able to raise people up, you have to give that skill to them. Now, I am in no way going to say that I am even close to that skill, but I would say listen and watch good speakers. As you know, at Toastmasters, we always talk about learning the skills of others. And one of the ways of best skills is watching how other people, because if we get excited about how they do it, I think that even if we can get 1% of what they say to you, it's great. So again, one of the most effective speakers that I've heard is Steve Jobs. It is just immensely. And I'm glad that I had a chance to watch him in live person several times, as well as on the video. And But again, those two people are probably the two most contributory to how I think and feel at this time.
Okay. And, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned Steve Jobs, right? Because he's a very influential, very impactful speaker, was a very influential and impactful speaker, certainly a legacy builder, and certainly somebody that, you know, whose name continues to live on today, even beyond his years. And it sounds like you and I are very similar, right? Like we gain a lot of insights from watching videos of high polished speakers, leaders, you know, influencers that have both the ability to articulate, motivate, lead, inspire. And so that's usually my go-to, where if it's not a YouTube video, it's a TEDx video. And, you know, I just find like different people that come to the platform with different perspectives is really remarkable. Richard, are you a book reader as well? Do you delve into like reading books, or do you focus mainly on digital platforms to gain your personal insights?
I have to admit, I'm a poor reader. So I am a digital reader. I'm a slow reader, as they call it, right? So, but I will say that, you know, now I read 300 and maybe 400 articles during my PhD. It was tortuous, but I did it. So I quickly found out that I find that digital delivery, whether it's video or podcast, is seemingly the best way for me. But I gain that because I know that I'm a poor reader. You know, that's one of the things. I regret not necessarily getting training quite on. I just kind of hit it, actually, that I was a poor reader all along. Everyone thought I was a great reader. No, I don't think I was. I can take a look at a book and, you know, skim it, and then I can immediately recite what it says. But if I really want to delve into a book, I probably had a hard time doing that.
And I'm in the same boat with you, Richard. So there's no, I mean, like, I thought I was the only one. Like, I struggle with like getting past like a certain number of pages, like, okay, just what is the purpose, right? But when you are immersed in watching a video, and I'm pretty good with listening to stories, so I can get into a story if I'm listening to a podcast or, you know, something, an audio book, like on Audible. But man, reading a book, oh, that is extremely tortuous. So you and I are aligned in that space. Dr. Hom, you know, you mentioned Steve Jobs. You know, a lot of the listeners today are listening because they are looking to glean insights in terms of how to advance their career. And one of the things that I find is that while we talk about influential leaders, those that are good leaders and how they can, you know, glean leadership development skills from them, you know, people are also looking for ways to understand how to, you know, position themselves and maybe even either brand themselves or promote themselves for the next level promotion. Are there, you know, speakers or, you know, resources that you turn to where you've realized has been helpful in your own advancement? Like, you know, is there a book or a source where you've said, you know what, I got a couple of steps out of this that I utilized in my own resume writing or in my LinkedIn profile or whatever that may be, that helped you open doors and network properly with better people to help create new opportunities for you?
Well, I've been fortunate to be able to continue my career as long as I have. And a lot of people ask me about how that is because, and so at some point, you know, in my early college careers, I actually was a peer mentor back in my undergraduate years. And I was pretty successful at that. And I actually kept that as interest. So I actually a pro bono mentor to beginning optometry students and many PhD students. So, when I usually, it really is kind of like a foundational step, you know, and I consider creating a foundational step first before looking at, you know, what other people are doing. One thing is to be able to, one of the things I focus on are people who are mid-career, who are looking to change their careers or some for some reason had to change their careers. And so I've been kind of like a magnet for some people. So what I always tell people is that let's go back to the foundational steps and rethink of what ways, you know, because one of the things that you have to get past a resume on a piece of paper is you have a personality and you have a kind of like enthusiasm, which you have to do to compete with other people. So one of the things you have to do is how can you stand out? And personal branding is one, again, but it's also having to be coupled with opportunity, creating the opportunity to connect. Because for the person who's in mid-career, they cannot depend on their resume alone as a way to get past the, what do you call, the HR gate, right? And that may mean that you may have to have a personal interaction of some sort, some way with someone in the company. And so that you can get interest that way. That's one thing. So, but continuously past the foundational steps is being engaged enough to interact with people. Now, once we've come to a kind of like a little bit of an obstacle in our life, we sometimes kind of say, we get shrink inwards and we don't want to talk to them, but and that's what we have to break. So that's a foundational issue, is that now we have to come out and really expose ourselves, because most people like to talk to other people. Most people like to meet other people. And unfortunately or not, people who hire people, they hire them because they like them. And the only way you can find out about whether you're liking them or not is you got to talk to them. You got to meet them. And it could be over Zoom. It could be by telephone. But I believe it has to go beyond email. Okay. And that's what's important. So that's what I call foundational. I believe that the personal interaction idea is probably the strongest. Now, books tend to be too, again, I'm not a book reader, so therefore they create such a plethora of strategies that sometimes people just don't know what to do. So what I try to do with my people that I mentor is to, glom on one or two ideas and strategies, make them successful at that, and then they start to have the confidence. And they actually don't need me anymore, because now they have the confidence. So what we have to do is looking at taking them out of their shell, learning them, teaching them, showing them a way that you have to, start interacting with people, networking, and then actually being able to have the greater confidence of demonstrating your personality by meeting people. So I think that not enough books talk about how much that is a struggle for people. They gloss it over and they say, well, okay, these are the things you got to do, the right resume, yada, yada. But before that, the right resume will only get you one place if you fail in the interview, right? And a lot of the videos you hear about, or books about videos and how you act, I have one situation. Somebody told me that they deliberately did not, the reason why they ask questions this off the wall, they do not want a rehearsed interviewee. Okay, so therefore, I remember at one time in the past that I had interviewed for with one of the big five consulting firms, and they routinely would throw out these questions that seeming like, where did they get them? But that was all to train you. So, and a lot of times in the past, I've actually went on interviews as a practice, just for the heck of it. And so I've actually learned what kind of questions they could throw at you. A lot of them at a certain level will throw you questions that just make you, that you could not practice ahead of time. So that's what the getting out of your shell is.
What's the most irrelevant question you've ever received during an interview?
Yeah, the first one I went was actually the parachute question. I'm not sure if you remember that. If you had three parachutes for people, how you decide which one will get the parachute, right? And that's one of them. And the other one was if you had, something similar to that was if you happen to have food, if you're trying to prepare a meal, how could you prepare the meal when you don't know anything about the people? And that's one of them. So these are questions that make you kind of imagine and what you have to do. And there actually is no right or wrong answer. It really depends on how well you can enumerate or elucidate the answer in a very clear and firm manner. I will say that there is a former CEO of, not former, he's currently the founder of Oracle. And I had the pleasure of meeting him on an elevator. And it's called the elevator pitch, right? And it had to be one sentence. So this gentleman asked me, what do you do here at Oracle? Okay, so you could answer it in many different ways. And I say, my job at Oracle is to make other people successful so that Oracle can become successful. Now, I just came out of my mouth. Just out of that. But that's the type of elevator pitch that you just got to automatically have at the command. And he smiled at me and he said, okay, here's another $1 million for your budget.
So, it's miraculous.
It was just like a chance event. I had no idea. And this is an obscure building. You know, the Linux building in Oracle is an obscure building out in the middle of nowhere. It's not even near the three towers, right? And he decided just to visit that obscure building at that time of the day when I was running up the elevator. It was really, and you know, my manager was with me. I was really shocked when I said it and shocked at the response. But that's what I'm saying is the fact that those are the type of interactions that you have to be able to be unwilling to say, because, you know, you could safely say it in some way. It's kind of a humdrum answer, you know, and whatever you do, but that's what you have to do. There's no right answer, but you have to be able to deliver something that would interest more people than yourself.
I think that that's very, very poignant in today's world, right? Like whether you are big into social media or you're big into like, you know, networking, the idea of conformity is actually very, very detrimental to progression, right? If you are just going to act, think, speak like everyone else, guess what? You are not going to get any farther than everyone else who is exactly in the same boat as you. So to speak differently, to look differently, and to be able to do it in a confident manner, I think really flummoxes a lot of professionals today, where they're relying on their skills, their education, their certification, and their experience to do the speaking for them on their behalf, when in reality, they are the ones that have to be able to create the right narrative. So when it is spoken to a person of influence and power, it has an impact immediately. So your elevator pitch story with the CEO of Oracle, very, very poignant. Dr. Hom, you've been so very insightful in this conversation. I have one final question to ask, and that is, you know, when you think about, you know, all the pearls of wisdom that you've dropped along this journey in this conversation that we've had, you know, we've talked about being curious. We've talked about, you know, as a leader, reaching back and identifying what you see as potential in others and cultivating that in them so that they're able to move on into different roles. And then even like just having this ability to lead in a community-based capacity to go and volunteer, like you've really opened up my eyes, and I'm sure many of my listeners' eyes as well, in terms of how to not just give back, but gain insights. You know, what is there one final piece of advice that you would share either to the listening audience or to your younger self? If you could go back in time and say, hey, you're going to see a lot of great things. You're going to do a lot of amazing things. But I would tell you that it's really critical that you do this, and we haven't talked about yet.
I think I would say is that whatever you do 5 years from then, it's not going to make a difference. So try it. In the greater scheme of things, there's no single thing that you can do that's a fatal error for the rest of your life. There are things you do, but we don't, you know, those are really off the wall type thing. But in general, regarding career or education, in fact, what I used to say is that regardless of your undergraduate degree, you can do whatever you want when you get out of it. So there are prescribed cases where, a particular degree will help you. But I'm beginning to think and really feel that any degree, if you what you can demonstrate is how you use that degree and how it will help other people. And so therefore, and how you choose to read is not going to decide for the rest of your life what's going to come out. So in other words, I always believe that what you do now, in most cases, isn't going to affect you 5 years from now. And so what you really are now trying to do is creating a track record that contributes to what the next step is. I always like to say is no matter what your situation, you ask yourself, what can I gain from this time period? Or this responsibility that I can use at the next opportunity. And so that's why, as an anecdote was, I was serving in a particular military location where it was lonely, it's in a big dark space in Germany. And it was like, we were in a foxhole, and it was lonely for 2 days in a row. And your imagination. Then I began to think, what can I do to make this particular experience useful for the future? And then I gained some insight. So if we can always ask ourselves that, I think that whatever you do, you'll learn from it. So you can either bypass or make less comfortable future events that could be the same fashion, or you can learn how to grow out of them.
I really appreciate that. Dr. Hom, you have been an incredible guest. Thank you for being on the Healthcare and Hire podcast. I'm very excited that you shared your story And I'm wishing you nothing but success as the year continues.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Healthcare and Hire podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow and subscribe for more. I'm your host, Iqbal Acha, and I invite you to connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Let me know what you thought about this episode or my show in general. Also, visit me at www.achainternational.com to learn more about how I help healthcare professionals and healthcare leaders advance their career, build a better brand, and create a leadership legacy. I'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, let's keep working to take healthcare to a higher level.